Phone check. 1, 2, the microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2, the microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They know I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my descrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Rome. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS of the Rook. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson-Owens.
And it's the 28th of January, sort of damp and coolish Saturday in Champaign-Urbana, and the airways overflow with nonsense. We're sitting here talking about
Bush's
heard on
press
NPR
conference
this morning. Well, there's plenty of that, exactly. But before we went on the air, we were talking about what National Public Radio did this morning, and Paul's favorite announcer, Scott Simon, talking with a remarkably bad and uninformed woman from from USA Today. She is, God help us, their diplomatic correspondent named Slavin, Barbara Slavin, I think.
I've heard her on the Beltway chat shows.
Whoa.
And she,
She's
actually better on some issues than she was today.
Well, it wouldn't be hard to be better than she was on some issues today. You quoted the
there's a problem there. The Palestinians have some difficulty giving up territory.
Yes, exactly. That was her analysis of the Palestinian question. And when it came to Iran, she said, well, of course, the Iranians are playing games. Yeah. Now, when you're getting this level of analysis from the diplomatic correspondent of USA Today, why are we surprised that people in this country are saying things like, poll this week that said 57% of Americans say, oh yes, the U.S. should attack Iran if it's building nuclear weapons. Well, when all the papers are saying exactly that, when John McCain, you know, the liberal Republican, stands up at Davos and says we have to attack Iran if they're making a nuclear weapon, and the ex-foreign minister from Australia who's sitting in the audience stands up and says, are you all going to make the same mistake again? And McCain says, we got to do it. I mean, if we don't do it, why, the Iranians will dominate the Middle East.
Yeah, I don't know.
Now, this is coming, as I say, from, you know, the quote, liberals, close quote.
There seems to be a good piece in Counterpunch about McCain and how he parades himself shows up on Saturday Night Live and is really hip and all, and but how bad he is on so many issues.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's
and he is more of a warmonger than most about Iran and Iraq.
Well, you know, I mean, except people like Joe Biden, the Democratic liberal senator. I mean, these are the folks who are screaming for blood in Iran. Once again, we have the remarkable phenomenon of the Democrats taking over the bloody shirt from the Republicans and running with it, so that the Republicans now, just amazingly, very quietly this week, the administration said, well, yes, we probably should do a deal where Russia will provide Iran with the fuel they want and do essentially what John Kerry proposed during the campaign that the Bush administration had no interest in when Kerry suggested it. Now the Bush administration has come around to Kerry's campaign position on providing Iran with nuclear materials and the good liberals like Biden and McCain are condemning them for it. Mrs. Clinton says, oh no, the administration has to be more belligerent towards Iran.
I was looking at the op-ed of the local college paper, a little established down the street. I don't often look at the op-eds, but there was another death of the UN op-ed, and I was looking, why is it dead this time? Is it oil for food? Or No, it's that the Security Council didn't refer Iran to the IEA, but actually, I think it's actually maybe it was the other way around. That, but it can't get any can't get any good backup from the UN these days for some reason. The point that we ended last week when we were talking about Iran was the fact that the settlement to the Gulf War one calls for efforts to demilitarize the entire region.
Exactly.
Where is that lost in the shuffle? Right. And that's really, I think, what we need to keep a drumbeat of, but you don't hear that anywhere in the press.
It's lost in the same place where the part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty that calls upon the United States to reduce its nuclear weapons and the nuclear powers in general to scale back nuclear weapons, that goes down the memory hole, too. We don't have to forget that.
Why shouldn't everybody want one, you know?
Exactly. Well, and indeed, there's a lot to be said for that. You know, Paul, there is an interesting problem here. I mean, we stand aghast as the administration runs exactly the same set of lies about Iran that they ran about Iraq. Well, they have nuclear weapons. They're going to attack Israel. They're going to attack us. They're a danger to themselves and others and so forth. You know, the difference is that, of course, Iran is trying to produce energy from nuclear materials under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And as you and I have said here before, given how the U.S. has acted in regard to Iraq and North Korea, it certainly would be remiss of any Iranian government, completely surrounded by hostile nuclear powers, not to be working towards a nuclear weapon. They certainly should be working towards it.
I don't often quote Saudi diplomats, but there was one that had an interesting insight. It says, what effectiveness does a nuclear weapon have for Iran other than, you know, maybe some kind of deterrent?
Exactly.
The actual use of it, they're going to blow up, you know, Israel, which is, you know, commingled with the West Bank, where one out of five citizens in the demographic problem in Israel within the Green Line itself is Palestinian. How can that be seriously taken as a weapon?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of posturing.
It's a deterrent, and that's exactly right, because what an Iranian bomb would do would make the ability of Israel with its perhaps 200 high-tech nuclear weapons, it would hedge Israel's ability to use those weapons to threaten the rest of the Middle East because of the danger of retaliation. I mean, remember, you know, we went for over a generation with the U.S. and the USSR deterring one another by having these sorts of nuclear weapons, and deterrence does work.
Well, I would prefer the NPT and the Gulf War UN resolution.
The U.S. is not willing to do it.
Yeah. Well, that would mean that the U.S. would have to.
Exactly.
We'd have to cut off the money to Israel because nominally we're not supposed to.
That's right.
To give any money to non-NPT signatories who are developing
nuclear weapons. That's right.
And that's how far skewed the the whole discourse is.
Well, it does. It always amuses me, though, when you see American spokesmen step forward at any level and so forth to talk about this issue, because they can't say that Israel has nuclear weapons. And so you get, you know, all these liars of the administration, when asked about this question, saying, well, you better ask Israel about that, or if Israel has nuclear weapons, then so forth and so on. I mean, you know, because for the very reason you suggest, no U.S. government can admit they in fact have them. And that they developed them outside any arrangement. Indeed, they hid the development from the U.S. too. So,
well, returning to Slavin and Simon for a moment, and it still illustrates the confusion on this on mm-hmm. this level about the Middle East and the Israel-Palestine conflict. Slavin suggests that, you know, maybe the Israelis should stop assassinating Hamas officials, and Simon says, "Well, on their behalf, they were saying they were terrorists." And,
yes.
But then it was pointed out. I think did Slavin point out that they were on a truce, or did that come up later? And later in the discussion with a guy named Rami Khoury out of Lebanon, mm-hmm. who Simon is interviewing, Simon points out, "Well, the Martyrs Brigade is talking about doing suicide bombing again. That they're going to re-pick it up." Well, Rami Khoury points out that. Well, they're not associated with Hamas. They're actually associated with the legacy of
Fatah. Yeah, exactly, right. And once again, we heard the same thing, the same propaganda on NPR this morning, that, of course, the real problem with Hamas is that it's a terrorist organization that doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. And if we could do one thing in this debate, Paul, it would be to deconstruct that term, a term that was invented as a defense of Israel when its actual actions were understood as so incredibly indefensible. Occupation of territories in contravention of UN resolutions, etc. But no, the real issue, say the apologists for Israel and the U.S., is Israel's right to exist. A wonderful job of changing the subject into something that, you know, in fact doesn't exist, a right to exist. The U.S., the United States of America, under the present Constitution, the present arrangement, is founded on the denial of a government's right to exist. Go read what the Declaration of Independence actually says. Governments are instituted among men, it says, to guard the rights, the natural rights of human beings. Whenever governments become destructive of those ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish them. There is no right for a government to exist, says the Declaration of Independence, unless it serves the interest of the people over which it rules. Now, the government of Israel rules from the Jordan River to the sea over a population roughly half Arab and half Jewish. It rules in favor or in the interest of a minority of this group, probably technically a minority this way, but certainly a small segment of the community, as the former apartheid government of South Africa did. Neither the apartheid government of South Africa nor the government of Israel has a right to exist according to American principles unless it guards the rights of its citizens, of the people over which it rules. That was the basis upon which the U.S. separated, the 13 colonies separated from Britain in the 18th century. So when we hear this right to exist talk, it really is worthwhile to put that, to draw back to basic American principles about which governments and when they have a right to exist and when they do.
Of course, it was citizens that were the important people, and during those days, women and unpropertied males, and of course, African indentured servants, etc., weren't really part of the constituency. But that is an aside, and that's more deconstruction on another level.
Yeah, so. That's a fortiori that I mean that the government was even less representative, even had less of a right to exist because, in fact, it wasn't looking out for the interests of the whole classes of citizens, as you say, within its territory. Now that the difference then becomes after the American Revolution was that the new American government also is held to the same standard that so when it does not serve the interests of the peoples over whom it rules, the people have the right to alter and abolish that government too. Mm. As for example, Abraham Lincoln recognized in his first inaugural address. Now this this notion, a fundamental American notion, has dropped out of American discussion, and instead we have American officials saying, well, the real issue here is whether Hamas will recognize Israel's right to exist. Nonsense. Yeah. That's wrong.
So much going on. I'll get to our Attorney General's discourse about that revolutionary era in a moment, but I wanted to point out the whole rush to democracy in the Middle East. Another irony in Bush's line, and I've heard it repeated by various spokesmen, is that political parties should not have armed militias. Well, in Iraq, an election that we applauded, it's an exceptional political party that doesn't have an armed militia. So,
Republican Party does pretty well with an armed militia, too. It's called the United States Military, right?
Well, they've been using the National Guard to spy on people. That's part of the whole spying. Scandal that a lot of which is still below the surface. Gonzalez's remark about Washington in that era was that, well, Washington was spying. Of course, he didn't point out. Of course, he didn't point out that he was living under a monarchy at the time, and he was aligning himself, for whatever motives, with the revolutionary movement. So it's like, okay.
Maybe the Attorney General thinks that monarchy model is does apply.
It's clear that,
but
it
as
does,
you say, yeah. It's yeah, as you say, it's he's spying for the wrong side. Maybe he's arguing that what's necessary is counter spying, huh? I don't know. I mean, the Brits certainly got their hands slapped in their spying in Russia this last week. I really sort of enjoyed that story.
Oh, wow. That was so Monday.
Yeah, I know. I know, but it was such a wonderful story.
Yeah,
I mean, here,
rock,
this high-tech, the high-tech rock in
Sometimes
the Russian Moscow Park.
Sometimes you had to kick it to get it to start emanating, apparently. I guess
jumpstart the spy system. Yeah, I thought that was wonderful. The Brits have a way of putting their foot into it, you know, on these matters. But the war is not going at all well for them. I mean, they've apparently alienated the militia and the Basra police now, and they're in the process of sending even more troops to Afghanistan.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, the military situation from the point of view of the Prime Minister of Great Britain is very, very bad and getting worse. And it's not much talked about over here about how it looks for them, but it's not good at all.
Yeah, even a Tory like Simon Jenkins, I guess, in the London Times writes a piece and decries Blair for sending more people into the miasma of South Afghanistan, and calls for cutting and running, basically, getting out completely, because we've messed it up so badly that the best thing to do is to get out.
Now, Blair is lucky the way Bush is in having feckless opposition. I mean, a new and untried Conservative Party leader, the Liberal Democrats in complete disarray. The most serious opposition within the political establishment comes from Labor's own backbenchers. And so it's difficult within that political establishment to mount any charge against a weak and dangerous prime minister.
So did you watch much of Bush's press conference? We sort of telegraphed we would say a few things like that. An interesting thing to note was that there actually was a question based on the Human Rights Watch report about torture being integral policy, deliberate and central policy. Mm-hmm. And Bush made a passionate statement that nobody in the world, can you hear say right now that nobody American in the world is torturing? Right. But then when he's asked further about the signing agreement, side agreement on the
signing statement,
so-called McCain torture amendment to the defense authorization, he points out that the president's prerogatives have to be kept. And so wink, wink, nod, nod.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a big lie, and people are still buying it. And that probably was a soundbite, and the second part probably didn't get picked up on too much.
So. And this is the same thing we're getting. I mean, this is clearly a worked out talking point for this administration. Same thing we're getting from this administration when they talk about the fact that the president is, as Judge Alito said, the president is subject to the law. Well, of course, the president is subject to the law. Of course, what they've done in the meantime is reinterpret the law to mean the supposedly constitutional powers of the president to do anything he wants in wartime as commander-in-chief, and therefore brush aside acts of Congress and so forth when they are understood to conflict with the president's prerogative as commander-in-chief in wartime. Now, they haven't quite used the word prerogative, because, of course, that was the word that was used by the absolute monarchy in Britain in the 17th century, and the revolution, the English Civil War of the 17th century, was against precisely that sort of executive prerogative. There's
they
a tradition.
They call it unitary power.
That's
now.
Right. You just name it something else.
And Alito says, well, that speech I gave to the Federalist Society where I talked about Alito, unitary power, I didn't mean anything like what anybody else meant by unitary power. I was talking about the power of the executive to enforce their EPA regulations, right. Or not, apparently, I guess, in this administration.
The outright lies that Alito told to that committee, that the committee seemed unwilling to take up, particularly the disavowal of earlier statements of his own like that and so forth, just quite amazing. And the Democrats have rolled over and stuck their little legs into the air and, said, no filibuster.
We have the irony of the New York Times saying the senators are spineless.
Right.
The New York Times that sat on the national security spying for a year, and also apparently, according to this column in the Counterpunch, that they have this editorial about Alito, but they're not covering what is actually going on. And actually, I'm still urging people. I've heard that despite the fact that Kerry announced this attempt to do some kind of filibuster from Davos, Switzerland,
right.
Which caused McClellan to chortle in his own particular way, that I still think we should make the valiant attempt to urge, particularly, again, Obama. Obama, if anybody can reread the transcript of some of the Friday testimony, particularly from this guy Gray, about the early civil rights cases about voter apportionment, reapportionment, et cetera, and then understand that Alito is not sympathetic to that at all, in truth, that anybody who's sympathetic to civil rights at all can vote for this guy and not call for joining the filibuster. I think people should write Obama and call him tomorrow morning early.
I think that's the difference,
or
Paul,
Monday
because Obama says, well, now he'll vote against Alito, but I mean, it's now safe to vote against Alito because it basically won't make any difference. What makes a difference is supporting a filibuster. They actually could stop the nomination with a filibuster, the Democrats are now saying, oh, well, we can't do that, we won't have enough votes and so forth, and therefore we're not even going to try. When Kerry calls for it from Davos, what the papers cover is the fact that he's that French guy and he's in Switzerland. They speak French there, don't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, now, administration figures who were interviewed from Davos this week, where the World Economic Forum was going on, are not, not treated that way.
John McCain was interviewed in the next segment
right.
from Davos. So.
That's right. You know, I didn't say, oh, that's the Frenchified John McCain, because, of course, what he's saying is perfectly in line with the essential agreements between Republicans and Democrats. Yeah, I think Obama is the worst example in some ways of someone who presents himself as a progressive and then refuses to go on board with the filibuster that would stop Alito, who really should be stopped.
Well, I don't think he's announced yet, has he?
No, he's announced that he will vote no.
Right.
A while back, he wasn't even
announcing that yet, which
that's,
was pretty
that's
amazing.
Quite right.
Where he
that's
should have
quite
been,
right.
He should have been deliberating whether he was going to lead a filibuster.
Well, and what's he been doing in the meantime? He went off to Israel. And just horrified folks who thought that he might say something progressive about Israel's occupation, and comes back saying, of course, we have to protect Israel's right to exist. I mean, he falls in with, quote, the liberal, close quote, wing of the Democratic Party, like Joe Biden, who says, of course, we've got to cut off money to Hamas now that Hamas has won the election in the occupied territories.
Well, he did meet with some Palestinians, which is more than Hillary Clinton did. She didn't even meet with anyone.
Yeah, you're talking about Obama now.
Obama did.
Obama met with Palestinians and told them they have got to behave the way that Israel wants them to. I mean, this was before the election, as a matter of fact, where the plan, as usual, is to find a Palestinian political unit that will be essentially the jailers that Israel wants to keep the Palestinian reservation quiet.
And, I guess there's another thing to argue, maybe for a filibuster, though, again, it's delicate. There's going to be a reauthorization of the Patriot Act nominally on February 2nd.
Right.
It'll include this no protest zone that was claimed earlier and has been overturned, but they're going to, this is part of the Patriot Act that's not much commented on that the ACLU is trying to get people to pay attention to. It would allow the whole downtown Seattle to have been declared an exclusion zone, so the demonstrations in 1990 would have not been able to happen. I think there were already suits against the size of the exclusion zone that they included already.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is clearly the way the administration is behaving, as we see, you know, in all the appearances of the, if you're old enough to remember Richard Nixon during the Vietnam War, when he did try to speak in public, there was always a demonstration against him and a group of people pointing out the crimes that the U.S. was committing in Southeast Asia. Well, now the Bush administration remembers that history too, and they make very sure that that doesn't happen when administration figures speak now. And this is just more backing for that. The Bill of Rights Defense Committee organized a call-in on the 25th, 3 days ago, over the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, and I'm sure that they got some support. There's a lot of dismay out there about the Patriot Act, but I think both Republicans or Democrats are quietly trying to fashion an acceptable bill that is acceptable to those Republicans and Democrats without too much public outcry, and they might be able to get away with it. We've got other things going on, and including the Supreme Court nomination and the State of the Union speech on Tuesday.
Yeah. Do you know who this guy Jason Leopold, who's been spinning out some great great stories on NSA and also on Karl Rove and the Plaingate thing for Counterpunch? Have you seen it? He's just called a writer, and he has a book coming out called News Junkie. Here's a title I like: From Your Mouth to His Ears, How Cheney Used the NSA for Domestic Spying Prior to 9/11. Apparently, they came in with a transition document that they asked the NSA to write that would allow them to already undelete names of people that were collected by accident, domestic spying. And apparently there's an allegation that this guy has some connections. He has some NSA people who won't go on record, but he said they would be happy to testify at the hearings that are coming up, supposedly, February 4th with the Judiciary Committee. On the Karl Rove issue, there's a certain email that's referred to by Miller from Time, I guess, that has still not been produced. Did Karl Rove hide or destroy evidence in the plane case? So NSA could probably get that if they wanted to, because they can get three levels of written over data files out of hard drives if they want to, but one wonders that they won't want to. And related, he also asserts that Fitzgerald is going after the business about the forgeries of the Niger document, and whether it'll lead to the Heritage Foundation and
Michael Ledeen
or not. I'm not sure.
One hopes so, but yeah, I don't know. I don't think we can.
Anyway, that's Counterpunch is knocking them out, including I guess one of the co-editors has got a new book out, Grand Theft Pentagon,
right,
in which they excerpt a bit about Ted Stevens and how much largesse he's getting. I guess we should mention the Canadian election. And
well, let's stop with Stevens for a minute, because I think that's a good point. This is Jeffrey Sinclair's new book called, as you say, Grand Theft Pentagon, available, I think, from Seven Stories or Common Courage.
Coming up soon,
And that's Jeffrey is a wonderful reporter who's dug into this sort of stuff in some detail. And the piece that he writes on Counterpunch this week is about Senator Ted Stevens. And remember who Stevens is. As the longest-serving senator in the chamber, if Denny Hastert, for example, were suddenly found to have a a problem like Nixon's vice president and was forced to resign because of some of the allegations, and there have been some, about the peculiarities of his financing. And Bush and Cheney were impeached, then the president would be Ted Stevens of Alaska,
yeah,
the president pro tem of the Senate. So this man is number four in line for the presidency. And what Jefferson Clear's article points out is that he's a... a complete sleaze in terms of the
milking the national budget.
Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he doesn't just find loopholes. He drills them. You know, by
the reason why I left to Canada is the geographic connection and
right.
the fact that a lot of the largesse that goes to Ted Stevens in Alaska is this missile defense Rube Goldberg. Basically,
that's a
money machine for Stevens, and now with this new Harper with a minority parliament, that was not pointed out chat show this morning. I wonder. We'll see what the limits of executive power in Canada are. Whether he can join in with the missile defense without having a parliament that backs it, because I think some of his own conservatives are probably not on board for
it. It'll be interesting because the liberal government, the outgoing liberal government, refused to cooperate with the U.S. there, to the U.S. great dismay, the U.S. government was quite angry about this, and it was thought that Stephen Harper, the new conservative prime minister of Canada, would be down with that, but his first public pronouncement after the election was that his mandate came from the Canadian people, he says, not from the U.S. ambassador. And the reason was that the U.S. ambassador to Canada had mentioned quite casually another thing that's a major issue between the U.S. and Canada, and that's the control of the Arctic Ocean, the Northwest Passage, as it's called, which with global warming is becoming more, it's becoming more and more important. But this has always been a bone of contention between the U.S. and Canada. Canada claims this as Canadian territorial waters, and the ambassador referred the day after the election to the neutral waters in the Arctic Ocean. And Harper was not willing to. I mean, it certainly does look like an attempt by the Americans to say, okay, now we've got a government in Canada that will do what it's told. And Harper realized that too and said, no way, you know, this is our position on that remains
the same. They kind of, with the previous Liberal premier, Paul Martin, they thought he was his guy, and he is. He's on board for Haiti, but apparently they had Bush went up there, and without any diplomatic groundwork, he announced now we can go ahead with missile defense without talking to anything, just presuming it on him too, and that was actually part of the reason why I guess this guy Martin couldn't be argued around to it. He couldn't. If they'd have tried to finesse it, he might have cooperated.
And they did.
They basically didn't.
Didn't think they had the pressure.
Speaking
and they
of other
did.
Diplomatic faux pas, the U.S. ambassador to India was saying that, implying that the. Cooperation with the civilian nuclear power in India, which is against NPT right now, it was a real scandal when they announced that they were going to go ahead. India is kind of in violation of their NPT. I guess they've abrogated it, so no other power should help them with their domestic. But he suggested that if they would hold that hostage if they didn't cooperate on isolating Iran, and it caused a great they could have finessed that as well, but they may have lost India's vote just by presuming that they can make the imperial edict and that their satrapies will follow them.
I think that's right. I mean, the remarkable arrogance that the American government shows in these matters is traditional. I mean, in it for a long time. This group is particularly bad, and signalized by people like John Bolton at the United Nations. But this government, I mean, one of the reasons the U.S. has made such a terrible mess of the occupation of Iraq, which should have been easy. I mean, there obviously should have been a walk in the park to occupy a prostrate country, which we had destroyed with a decade of sanctions. But the incredible arrogance that, of course, the U.S. writ is going to run. It'll bring some money and throw the money around. The money is all stolen and so forth, as a recent audit shows. That's right. That doesn't matter. I mean, you know, this is the way we're going to do it. Condoleezza Rice goes to Europe and says, of course, the U.S. doesn't torture. Well, and the Europeans are supposed to say, oh, yes, that's right, the European doesn't torture, when they have evidence across the board throughout Europe and elsewhere of torture programs, torture policies, rendition programs, the whole thing that the U.S. does. I mean, the chutzpah, I choose the word advisedly, of the American government to stand up and say we don't torture is not lost on the rest of the world. Yeah. And the only reason that this sort of impolitic statement is possible is a profound arrogance on the part of the American representatives.
Well,
amazing.
She reads German, so she probably looked at the article that had the headline, "Does anyone believe this woman?"
Well, exactly, yeah. If she reads German, I hope her German's better than her Russian. She's supposed to be a Russian specialist, and apparently her Russian isn't very good. So, in any case.
First I heard of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Capitol Hill Blue?
Oh, I don't know. I think there was some, she actually made the mistake of trying to speak a little Russian in the last her last visit to Moscow.
No, and
to great hilarity.
All those dative cases, of course.
Yeah, maybe that was the problem. What's the story with George Galloway? I guess we were talking about British politics for a while ago, and I was saying something about no serious opposition to Blair.
I saw his image in a leotard pretending to be a pussycat.
This is.
He's been divorced by his Palestinian wife, and I don't know if she just threw some shoes out his doorway or something, but.
Doesn't
he says he's trying to communicate with people that don't normally hear or bother with politics. So
we're talking about George Galloway, the independent member of parliament in Britain, who was turfed out of the Labour Party for opposing the war, and was re-elected on an independent party from a London district, a London constituency, an East London constituency.
He won another libel case, so he's independently politically funded, so he doesn't have to worry about a respect party or any party, I guess.
Well, the British Secret Service did a great deal to try to blacken his reputation by saying, we've got documents that prove that Saddam Hussein was paying him, amazing sorts of stuff, the documents were obvious fakes. I mean, not obvious. They were well done and professionally done, but when examined, they proved to be fakes. And under the British libel laws, he's actually recovered a fair amount of money from a number of papers, British, including the Daily Telegraph in Britain. And but the problem is, I mean, the whole quote notion of sort of serious opposition to what the government is doing. He's gone on a reality show, reality TV show. It seems a terrible name
because
obviously
off
unreal.
This past
That's right.
Days, yeah.
And he's now being sued for neglecting his responsibilities as a member of parliament the whole deal is you're locked into this mm-hmm. this setting for a couple of weeks, and it's the way these foolish shows go. Well, his explanation was that he was doing it in order to reach people who don't listen to the news and so forth, but the folks who put the reality show together very carefully, which is apparently a Dutch concern, these Big Brother shows, as they're called, which are many countries are licensed by this Dutch company, the Dutch television production company that does it. They have cut out all his political discussions from what was actually broadcast of the show. Mm. So he thought this was a place you sit around in this
well,
in the city and talk about these
culture,
matters.
I guess we have to talk about Oprah and her flip-flopping on this book. And my best line was, again, from TV. Craig Ferguson said, "He's a junkie."
Yeah.
"He's a junkie. What do you expect him to tell the truth? Oh, he was a reform junkie. Well.
But that seems to have little political content, whereas the Galloway business does, in the sense that that Galloway's not unreasonable starting position was, this will be a way to talk about these matters to people who don't hear about them in our country. Unfortunately, that apparently has been stopped.
Well, I don't know. Implications about publishing, if Regnery publishes something like Rebel in Chief from Barnes, which I don't think they do have that, but somebody published this. I wonder how much fact-checking they'll do on Bush's memoirs if you get somebody to write them.
Well, I don't think you know.
Well, you introduced the popular culture, but yeah you're right. I think political dimension in the sense. Well, they, you
Oprah
know,
and Fry, if you know, is
like I say, he's got so much money from the cases, he doesn't really need a party to back him anymore, and big sums. Fleet Street's going to have to do some even more manipulative and exploitative journalism to make sure people still pick up the rags, and so they can afford to pay off all these suits.
There is something to the case of Oprah and Fry, and in that there has been a remarkable amount of publicity about this thing. I mean, I was really quite astonished. And when the revelations, which came originally from an interesting website called Raw Story, about the fact that this thing was made up.
Smoking Gun. Let's get our facts straight. Raw Story didn't actually bother with this story that much. It's Smoking Gun.
The point was that this guy had said in this book was revealed to be made up. But what is astonishing is how much talk there's been about it. I mean, this is a way of avoiding the fact that the U.S. continues to kill people at a great rate in Iraq, and the administration is manipulating the possibility of killing more people in Iran and so forth as a way to maintain its hold on the on the American populace. But instead of these things being analyzed any serious way, we get Oprah.
Would that the Osama Book Club, with this reference to Rogue Nation, be discussed as much in its content, et cetera, et cetera?
William Blum's book that was referred to in the Osama bin Laden interview. The Washington Post today carries an article entitled, this is the headline, Blogs Attack from the Left. And the burden of the article is that the reason the Democratic Party is in serious trouble is that there's a split in the Democratic Party between the serious party people who really want to put together a party and run a candidate and, you know, win national office and so forth.
Like they're comfortable and with.
And these crazy weblogs where people are off saying just terrible things that don't support, the Democrats. I mean, basically the mainstream Democrats like, the Clintons, for example. The Washington Post is saying, this is really a terrible thing, and unless something can be done about these blogs,
Is this a Howie Kurtz thing? He's supposed to be their media beat guy.
No,
he didn't even bother with it. Huh?
No. But I mean, he's probably said it earlier.
This guy's just cribbing.
One of their major reporters, Philip Colt Vanderhei, does it. It's interesting, given the fact that we also this week saw the plunging revenues of the New York Times, which I thought might be connected with the Democrats Need a Spine editorial this week. As people move away more and more from traditional media, there is a great deal of worry about where people, in fact, are getting their news from. And one of those places is these, quote, blogs attacking from the left.
They're leaving so much out that, you have to go somewhere else to find some real discussion, and I
but people know that now. I mean, it wasn't that long ago in this country, Paul, where people said, well, as a matter of course, we have a free press in this country, therefore we must be getting the truth. The free press must be telling us the truth, because if it weren't, there's some other press would leap up and tell us that truth. And so they said, looked around. I'm talking about the American media scene a generation ago. They looked around and said, we have all these newspapers in this country, all these independent media groups and so forth, without noticing that they were all saying the same thing, and that the situation contrasted sharply with that in, say, the former Soviet Union, where people knew the media was controlled and therefore read between the lines or got the BBC or got something else to find out about that. The U.S. is closer, I think, to the quote totalitarian close quote situation now than it was a generation ago.
Well, they're making a big deal. In fact, even in the News Gazette, Jim Dye takes on this business about Abramoff, and the Washington Post mentioning that they got money from both sides.
Right.
He gave money to both sides, which the guy just still won't let go of. It's really not substantively true. He says that money was directed from people that were his clients were directed. Well, you know, these people gave money before Emmerhoff was there.
Yeah,
their right. lobbyist. So it's a bunch of crap. And Durbin gave money back from this locally based Indian center in Chicago. He gave it to Indian Native American charities, so that was at least a good stroke. But
it's interesting though that the defense.
Why did he have to? Because it wasn't directed by Abramoff. It was I think this local group wasn't even really related to Abramoff. They weren't trying to get any casinos. Abramoff, this business, the coverage again, Democracy Now! Did it best. Abramoff was such a bottom feeder that he was actually trying to get the elders of the tribes to let him write insurance policies on their on elderly dying natives so he could make some more money out of them.
You
it's
notice
outrageous
what
stuff.
You notice what Day doesn't mention in that article in this morning's News Gazette too is any connection of Abramoff with Israel. I mean, we know that Abramoff was deeply concerned about channeling money to the settlers, to the extremists on the West Bank, and that even money from his American Indian clients ended up buying sniper scopes and night vision goggles and things like this for snipers, for settlers in the West Bank. We also heard this last week that there seems to be an interesting connection between Abramoff and South Africa. Now, South Africa before, apartheid South Africa.
He did a film about lionizing that monster in Angola. Savimbi. I mean, incredible. Red Scorpion, I guess, is the name of it. Right?
And this is, I mean, none of this, of course, comes up, but it seems to me it's, in a sense, a council of despair that the Republican talking point, which is basically what you hear Jim Day elaborate in, or you see Jim Day elaborate this morning's newspaper, the Republican talking point is, oh, everybody does it. Now that's a very interesting line to have to take. First of all, they know they can't defend this massive criminal activity that Abramoff was involved with, and therefore they say, well, yeah, okay. They use the argument that in classical rhetoric is called tu quoque. You're just as bad. The Washington Post jumps in with that and then say they have to shut down their comment because people were being obscene. Well, what they were being obscene about was pointing out how the Washington Post was doing the Republican talking point.
Bad faith about the fact that everybody does it. I sort of barged into a little party for Tim Johnson this week that was sponsored, to my chagrin, by IPERG, the Public Interest Group. A research group of Illinois, where they're thanking
the
purpose was to thank him for his support for smart solutions and particularly hybrid vehicle. You know,
isn't that outrageous?
I said this is terribly myopic. For one thing, let's ask our representative about where he stands on mass transit. I mean, I'm all for raising the CAFE standards and getting more efficiency out of the gasoline, but what about a strategy that actually gets people out of their cars more?
Well, this is also the man who is the darling of Exelon Corporation, the single largest recipient of monies from the folks who want to build a new nuclear plant.
I wasn't going to be allowed to have another question. I was sort of cut off in that situation, too. But a guy behind me asked him about nuclear power, and so I started saying, well, you're the one who got $2,000 from Exelon right around the time they got $23 million to help them fill out the forms for Clinton II.
Hey, you've always liked that, haven't you?
Oh, I said I'm not saying it's quid pro quo, but it's quite interesting to see, and here you are being lionized for your environmental. And the reporting didn't say anything about his stance on nuclear power. So,
why does Exelon want to give money to an obscure Southern Illinois congressman? I mean, I've mentioned before that when this happened, the New York Times so misunderstood the situation that they thought it was Tim Johnson, former senator from South Dakota, who had received all this money from Exelon. Senator from South Dakota, who was
voting for Alito too.
And that's right. Yeah. And they were scratching their head about why is Exelon giving a South Dakota senator the money? Well, the situation, and it made much more sense when you realized what Exelon's business was and what they wanted to do and why they wanted to buy a congressman and
sort of a British transnational. As I've been finding out that RWE that is doing push polls around our town to make it look like the municipalities are getting not doing their city business when because they want to re-municipalize or municipalize for the first time, I guess, the water system, if it is going to be sold, doing this push-pull that's made some. It's actually above the fold front page on the same paper that the.
Yeah, they've even gotten the mayors of Champaign and Urbana upset about it, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's actually RWE Thames. Apparently, it's mainly German money, but the Thames outfit is the major operator. Apparently,
maybe they just swam up the Thames and beached themselves or something.
Yeah. Well, they're here, and we'd like to get rid of them. And Peoria has a.
Drag them out like a dead whale.
Has a 5-year cycle where they have the right of first refusal, so they might be able to municipalize their water system. Illinois is behind 60% only, or two-thirds or so only of water systems in Illinois are municipal, whereas actually it's around 80% nationwide. Anyway,
did
a
you
little local issue there for you?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's not unconnected. Everything is connected in the old SDS.
Well,
monitor.
Water, worldwide is a very, very. You know, you can look at Bechtel in Bolivia.
Bolivia is extremely important example of that, and that's one that's making the lights burn late in Foggy Bottom right now.
Yeah, they're still. I think Bechtel is still suing Bolivia for breach of contract
because they want their water back.
They want their right to charge for the water.
That's right. This Republican, this Council of Desperation, and the Republican is trying to say, well, of course, Abraham Alf was a bad guy, but everybody else does it, has extended now to ethics charges in the House against 10 representatives, including Jan Schakowsky. They want an ethics investigation on that. Her husband was involved in tax fraud, and she signed their joint tax reforms. And so the Republicans say, yes, here's some more.
Tax fraud. He was kiting. Kiting checks.
Yeah, but I mean, what he's being charged with is tax fraud. Because and this is the connection that the House Republicans want to use.
She's such a great representative too. But, she's been good on Columbia and all sorts of. All sorts of issues.
But still in all, for the Republicans to be saying, well, everybody does it and everybody's equally guilty, is very nice indeed. We can live with that.
Everybody wants to see these Abramoff-Bush photos that I want to know how much they went for. These were photo ops that he was charging, FaceTime with the president. Yeah. And where did that money go? Did that did Bush get a kickback for... for helping his guy out. Abramoff was on the transition team, too, in some regard. I don't remember the actual specifics of it. So this idea that Bush never met him is probably a blatant lie, too, and doesn't remember him or if he met him, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
These economic questions may become increasingly important. We did get word this week that the U.S. economic growth slowed in the last quarter of last year down to 1.1%, that the rich-poor gap in income grew even greater, and that with a 3-year low in growth and a series of indicators suggesting that the business outlook for the coming year are not good, the administration may be worried. They're running a huge deficit now. I mean, the deficit is out of sight. And the new budget proposals from this administration include such things as cutting back the Army, reducing the Army Reserve, reducing the National Guard, and, of course, as you mentioned before, no more reconstruction money for Iraq. I mean, they're getting worried about this, and they know they can't fill their recruiting quotas, therefore they have to run the quotas down. The combination of a threatening bad economy and oppositions to their policies means that we're seeing some adjustments, and we'll hear about this Tuesday night when we hear about all the good things the government will be doing for us in the coming year.
They certainly had to adjust Bush's speech, because I'm sure the economic record was going to be a major section of it. Now he'll have to qualify it because of this slowest growth in 3 years,
right,
adjusted for, et cetera, et cetera. I think we should note that this is the Challenger accident, and this is a dead horse for me, but I'll beat it again, that the reason why they went ahead with that flight, despite the fact that the Thiokol people were saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, was that it was written into Reagan's speech. The coverage again on NPR today played a segment of Bush's fireside chat that he gave commending the Challenger people to God.
Reagan's, you mean, Fireside Chat.
Did I say Reagan?
Yeah, you said Bush. Yeah.
Well, Reagan...
But your point is well taken.
Yeah. I mean, well, NPR didn't mention that it had canceled the State of the Union
address,
and it's still a lot of people's contention, though not much spoken of because Reagan is so lionized, of course, these days.
Well, lionized by some.
Yeah, by the media, by many. Mm-hmm. You know, even people that supposedly don't like him, et cetera, say, well, you know, he could communicate.
This is nonsense. Pure myth-making and propaganda, of course.
Yeah, the lowest approval rating of any president before him. I don't know how the record is going these days.
Yeah,
it was down to like 37% approval, which I think Bush probably did break that, didn't he? Wasn't he down? Well, plus or minus. They're both in the same. They both got into the same area, plus or minus the polling errors.
But this notion of Ronald Reagan, the much-loved ex-president, is a media creation entirely. He wasn't. We have a comment from Ed Mundell.
No, actually, it wasn't a comment, it was a phone call.
Okay.
A phone call I had with the in Peoria. There was an 8-2 vote or something to that effect.
They didn't want to get in on the coalition to investigate the possibilities of finding a way to municipalize the water in a sort of a grand pack in the region so that they might... The corporation might find it a little. There's a bill, actually, by a Republican representative from the Peoria area that would, if it goes through the state house, it'll give all municipalities the right of first refusal. So that I don't have the number on that, but you can probably find it. And if it's not in the News Gazette's article reporting it today, I guess, we can criticize them about that.
Well, we're talking about the Abramoff matter and these councils of despair we're getting from the Republicans. I thought amazing this week. There was almost no mention of the fact that the prosecutor in the Justice Department, who has been running the Abramoff matter, was suddenly appointed a federal judge by the Bush administration. I mean, you know, good heavens! You know, how can you possibly understand? I mean, several people's response to that was obvious. Look, we need a special prosecutor here, not prosecutors that can be bribed or manipulated by the administration. We certainly do. And it'll be interesting to see what happens to this case now, because obviously the Bush administration is moving heaven and earth to try to put a lid on it. But lordy, I mean, what an expedient, you know, buy off the prosecutor by making him a judge. That's
incredible.
I think
they actually did something similar to this in a previous scandal. I don't remember the actual record, and I guess we won't be able to speculate on it at this point.
This has been Carl Easterbrook and Paul Muth, the news from Neptune. Inshallah, we'll be back next week to do this again. And
Obama.
And so we will be out of here.